Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, June 5th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Esther Men. Today's session number is 98.5, and it's titled Bible Study, Matthew chapter 22, verses 1 through 14, Parable of the Banquet. This is the fourth session in a series of four, based on the theme, Eating Together, Stories of Hospitality and Hope. Let's listen in.
Series on Eating Together, Stories of Hospitality and Hope, and today we're going to spend part of our time, anyway, on the parable of the wedding banquet in Matthew 22, 1-14. I was reading this through yesterday, I realized that it would take some effort to include it strongly in the stories of hospitality and hope. Because there's a lot of other things going on in there. It's rather a shocking story. So I thought I'd start out with some other passages to sort of put it in context, and then we'll look at that at the end. Feasting has been a very staple image of restoration, of wholeness, and a way of peace and justice in the Bible. And I thought that it might do us good to read a chapter from Isaiah 55, 1-13, just to get one poetic expression of that image of feasting, of eating, as a way of life, a metaphor for a way of life. Let's see here. The way of life, I should say, not eating as a way of life, that would never be a very large part, but as sort of the fourth life.
55.
So 55 is it's a beautiful poem here. Does someone want to start reading? And I think it's worth reading the whole thing, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh, everyone who thirsts, come to the water. And you that have no money, come, buy, and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen carefully to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Listen, so that you may live. I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. See, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. See, you shall call nations that you do not know, and nations that do not know you shall run to you because of the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake their way and the righteous their thoughts. Let them return to the Lord, that he may have mercy on them, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon them. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and do not return there until they have watered the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes out from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose, and succeed in the thing for which I sent it. For you shall go out in joy, and be led back in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall burst into song, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress, instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle, and it shall be to the Lord for a memorial, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off.
So in this passage, you start out with this invitation to eat the bread that will satisfy, obtain this wine, this milk, without any money. It's very freely given, so an invitation to freely partake of the bread that satisfies. Invitation to delight yourself in rich food. And then there, in the next verse, there's this reference to the covenant with David, the everlasting covenant with David, and the call to all the nations coming in. So this would have a resonance in Christian years to Jesus and to all of it, bringing in of all the nations. What I find interesting is that in this poem that begins with feasting and bringing all peoples in, the next verse talks about not just this bounty of this banquet, but also justice and righteousness as part of that. Seeking the Lord and returning to the Lord will pardon. So the theme of righteousness and justice is along in with that theme of feasting together. Oh, I'm sorry.
Not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Isaiah 55. Mm-hmm. Isaiah 55, we're starting with.
Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, is that Isaiah?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
And in this next, in 10 through 11, about the rain and the snow coming down, they don't return until they've watered the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, getting seed to sower and bread to the eater. So you have this image of this water coming down and giving bread to the eater. So my word that goes out from my mouth, it resonates with that image of the bread from heaven. And then it's rain from heaven, but it doesn't return until it's become bread for all to eat. So the word of my mouth does not go until it's accomplished. And in Deuteronomy, there's an interpretation of the manna as the word of God that's coming down to feed the people. So I think there's these kind of resonances, and also resonates with the passage that we were reading yesterday, too, about Jesus. When he says, I am the bread of life, the bread of heaven, and so forth. So there's a lot of very rich associations in this passage. And then, of course, that beautiful conclusion of going out in joy, being led back in peace, with all the mountains and hills bursting into song, and the trees clapping their hands. It's a beautiful passage. Anybody have observations about this that they'd like to share? I thought this would give us some kind of a context for looking at these the material that we're going to look for today, this kind of background. But just before we move on, any strong reactions or?
I guess just our surroundings. We have mountains around us. And
mm-hmm.
It's a good repeat.
I was thinking yesterday as I was weeding a flower bed over by the shelter by the dorm that I'm in, by the time I was finished, it was full of grass in the midst of all the daisies there. And by the time I finished pulling the weeds out of them, they looked like they'd been run through a meat grinder, the daisies too, because it was very difficult to pull the weeds out without disturbing the daisies. And last night, when the rain came, and I walked by the daisies on my way back to my room after Vespers, there was all the plants that had been ravaged by my hands as I was pulling the weeds out of me were all standing up and strong and I guess I don't know. I was thinking about the unrighteousness and pulling the weeds out and the chaff and that sort of thing, and I looked at
and how the water refurbished it.
Yeah, and then when I was thinking about that when you read the seek ye the Lord, seek the Lord while he may be found, and then the rain and the snow comes down and nourishes and gives strength and even to the flowers, and they sing. I guess, as I think about that, too.
Sure they do.
They have a song and a story to tell. Mm-hmm. So, doesn't have much to do with eating, but...
Yeah, there's that joyfulness.
Yeah, it's just, it brought me joy because I felt so terrible for destroying. But it looked like I was destroying these poor flowers. And there was joy in me as I saw them regain life again. Right. Just by rain.
And keep that metaphor in mind as we go when we get to the Matthew parable.
We need some joy.
There's a sort of a cantata by Randall Thompson, American 20th century American composer, that it's called The Peaceable Kingdom. And the second to last movement is verse 12 here. For you shall go out in joy and be led back in peace, and the mountains and the hills before you shall burst into song, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. It ends there, and then the second to last movement, and then the last movement is, ye shall have a song and gladness of heart. But all the movements before that are judgment. It's almost entirely Isaiah text. There's some Jeremiah in it, but it's mostly Isaiah. It's very harsh, dramatic, frightening music. Undoubtedly the best thing that Randall Thompson ever wrote. I think really a masterpiece. And a group that I conducted performed it during Advent, because the place that I was working really wanted to observe Advent right up till Christmas Eve. They went at Advent, and the dean of this chapel said Advent is a little Lent. So he wanted the words of Isaiah along with this promise before Christ came at Christmas. And I thought of that because this thing that we're supposed to be reading for today is pretty judgmental.
Well, you know, it's interesting because even in this passage in Isaiah 55, you have that reference to righteousness and justice and so forth. So
yeah.
Even though there's it's very positive and uplifting, still you have those terms which sort of imply a moral judgment as well.
An obligation, too.
An obligation.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right.
More than judgment,
yeah,
it
right.
Seems to me it's an obligation.
Mm-hmm.
And
very good point. There are numerous other places where you have eating as a very important image. And if we had time, we could look at some others of these. I just want to mention right now, and if you want to glance quickly, we won't read the whole thing, but in Proverbs 8, it's all about wisdom. There's a personification of wisdom, of God's wisdom. And it talks about how wisdom was present at the creation of the earth, at the very beginning of the earth, there with God, before the mountains had been shaped and the hills and so forth, when God was establishing the heavens and drawing a circle on the face of the deep, so wisdom was present there beside him, his daily delight, rejoicing in him, and also then rejoicing in the inhabited world that God had created, and in the human race in particular. And after that, wisdom seems to remain present with the human world, inviting them into the ways of God, because she had knowledge of the ways of God. So she says, and now my children, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways. Hear instruction, be wise, do not neglect it. Happy is the one who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my door. Whoever finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But whoever misses me, injure themselves, all who hate me love death. This is the end of 8. And then in 9 it begins, wisdom has built her house. She's hewn her 7 pillars. She's slaughtered her animals. She's mixed her wine. She's also set her table. She sent out her servant girls. She calls from the highest places in the town. You that are simple, turn in here. To those without sense, she says, come, eat of my bread and drink of the wine I've mixed. Lay aside immaturity and live and walk in the way of insight. So you do, you have wisdom, God's wisdom, calling everybody. There's a way to live, and she offers it. So you have the servant girls going out.
You that are simple. I think that's an interesting word to say. You that are simple. It's a reference to children again, I think, in some ways. Jesus said it was one such as these will be entering into my kingdom because their trust is complete.
Mm-hmm. And the whole purpose of the book of Proverbs is the education of the son, mm-hmm. specifically. There's all these injunctions to the son to listen to the words of his father and mother. And there's always the contrast between the simple and the wise.
Mm-hmm.
actually, there's even another contrast between the foolish and the wise, kind of the two paths. But wisdom is inviting everybody to the path of wisdom, which is the path of righteousness. And she does it by sending out her servant girls and calling everybody to a banquet. So here you have this theme of the invitation to the banquet. Well, the banquet imagery as a sense of eschatology developed in Israel, the sense that there would be an ending, a world to come. You don't have that in a lot of the Old Testament writings, but it did develop this sense that this world wouldn't be the only world that, because there's so much injustice in it and so forth, that it had to be set right in the world to come in the Messianic age. And we have the theme of the banquet, or the image of the banquet, a very common one in Rabbinic Judaism that developed parallel to Christianity. So, for example, Psalm 23, where it says, "You have set out a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You, my cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." I'm just taking a few phrases from there. But that was interpreted within Rabbinic Judaism as a picture of the world to come, the banquet for the righteous, that all would partake forever. God would set the table and people would eat abundantly. The righteous would get their reward. So, a very common image then of the reward of the righteous in the world to come, in the future. And also in Christianity, the banquet came to take on those kinds of associations too. Although, there's a variation on this feasting theme in Christianity, and it's often depicted as a wedding feast because of the metaphor of the relationship between Christ and the church as the groom and bride, which emphasizes, you know, their closeness, their intimacy, their love. And we can see there's a few short passages that we might look at just to review or refresh our memories about that. Matthew 9:15 uses the imagery of the bridegroom. Let's see, which probably should be 14 through 15. Would somebody read that?
Then the followers of John the Baptist came to Jesus asking, "Why is it that we and the Pharisees fast often, but your disciples don't fast at all?" Jesus answered, "Do you expect the guests at a wedding party to be sad as long as the bridegroom is with them? Of course not. But the day will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast."
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here you have that reference to Jesus asked the question, can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? So, referring to his presence there in the community. But if we look at Revelation 19, 7 through 9, there's another development of this theme of the bridegroom as Christ with them. This is placed not during the period of Jesus' earthly ministry, but is also an eschatological vision. Let's see, 7 through 9 have the most graphic image, but I think we want to get just a little jump start. If I can find that. Oh, yes, okay. So we probably want to start at 6. Yeah, that would be good. 6 to 8, I think, would be the... Oh, 6 to 9, you got to do 9, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 6 to 9, would somebody do that? Mm-hmm. You want to read that?
Sure. Then in verse 6, "Then I heard what seemed to be the voice of a great multitude, like the sound of many waters." Is this correct?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
"And like the sound of mighty thunder peals crying out, 'Hallelujah, for the Lord our God, the Almighty reigns. Let us rejoice and exult and give him the glory. For the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his bride has made herself ready. To her it has been granted to be clothed with fine linen, bright and pure. For the fine linen is the righteous deeds of the saints. And go on. And the angel said to me, write this. Blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, these are true words of God.
Okay. So here we have this vision of the marriage of the Lamb with the bride, the church, who's clothed in this fine, bright linen, the brightest deed to the saint. All right. So with these passages in mind, I think we'll turn to a parable that Jesus told about a feast. And actually, this parable appears in two places, two different versions. The first is in Luke 14, and then the second is in Matthew 22. And Jesus, as you're probably already aware, uses parables a lot. Simple, short stories for teaching, illustrating point using common language, common situations that would be easily understandable and pointing them to a larger truth. Parables, by the way, are very common in Jewish literature as well. So Jesus is drawing on a type of teaching device that would have been very familiar to his audience, to his Jewish audience, and he would have come out of an environment that loved using these kinds of parables. And interestingly enough, the parable of the king, God as king, is very common in rabbinic literature. And I'll read you an example toward the end of the class of that type of parable. The first version that we have is in Luke, and we might want to just read that through quickly to get that in our mind too before we finally make it to our main passage. That's in Luke 14. Now it's interesting, both Luke and Matthew have versions of this parable. And this is typical that you'll have teachings of Jesus that are shared by Luke and Matthew. Mark has a lot of the events and the same chronology as Matthew and Luke. And it seems that Matthew and Luke based their Gospels on Mark or an earlier version of what we have now is Mark. But they also added a lot of teachings of Jesus. And so it's no coincidence that both Matthew and Luke share a parable. So, turn this up a little bit. Now, in Luke, Jesus tells this parable about a meal at a meal. It's a very nice setting here. Starting at 14, Jesus was going to the house of a leader of the Pharisees to eat a meal on the Sabbath. So he's been entertained. He's the guest at a meal. And there's first there's a healing on the Sabbath, so there's a bit of a dispute here between the lawyers and the Pharisees, I guess his hosts, about whether it's appropriate or not. But after that, he tells three different teachings about being at meals. So this is a rather nice little detail here. It reminds of one who knows about the Greek world of the symposium, right, where people are gathered and they talk about philosophy and important things. And here, Jesus begins speaking about appropriate behavior at meals, starting in 7. And exactly that parable that I mentioned earlier about when you're invited to a wedding banquet, don't sit down in a place of honor, because then you might have to move. That would be so embarrassing, but rather sit someplace else and be asked up. So we have the reference to the wedding banquet here at the beginning. And then the second teaching starts in 12, and this is to the host. When you give a party, luncheon or dinner, don't just invite your friends, because then they'll have to pay you back, right? But invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind, and then you'll be blessed because they can't repay you. You'll be repaid the resurrection of the righteous. So instructions to hosts about who to invite, the crippled, the lame, and then the poor, the blind. And then we launch into the parable here. And so I think that the material that precedes leads right in here. And especially the reference to resurrection of the righteous sort of sets up a certain resonance. I think, oh, maybe this parable is about something more than just a meal. But why don't we read from 15 through 24 here?
Would you like to read? Excellent. One of the dinner guests, on hearing this, said to him, "Blessed is anyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God." Then Jesus said to him, "Someone gave a great dinner and invited many. At the time for the dinner, he sent his slave to say to those who had been invited, 'Come, for everything is ready now.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said to him, 'I have bought a piece of land and I must go out and see it. Please accept my regrets.' Another said, 'I have bought 5 yoke of oxen and I am going to try them out. Please accept my regrets.' Another said, 'I have just been married and therefore I cannot come.' So the slave returned and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and said to his slave, 'Go out at once into the streets and lanes of the town and bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.' And the slave said, 'Sir, what you ordered has been done, and there is still room.' Then the master said to the slave, 'Go out into the roads and lanes and compel people to come in so that my house may be filled. For I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste my dinner.'"
Oh. The old of hospitality and hope. Now, I was going to choose this one for my Bible study. That's why I remembered 14 in my mind last session, Luke 14. But then I realized the whole point that none of these who were invited will taste my dinner. I suppose the other one has the same point in a way, but this is so explicit. At least in the one that we're going to concentrate on, it says many are invited, but fewer chosen. Few, you know, at least few. Okay, we'll at least have that humor of folk there. But okay, so what do we see here in this parable? Here we have a simple story, right? Is this a plausible story?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a plausible story. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
It's like no second chance.
No second chance, uh-huh. That always puzzles me. Okay, someone gave a great dinner. Here, this is someone, not a king. Invited many, and no one accepted his invitation.
Who was that someone to begin with?
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. Doesn't tell us anything about him. He has a slave. Giving a dinner. Because it's talking about the resurrection, and because one of the dinner guests says, "Blessed is anyone who eats bread in the kingdom of God," seems to refer to, you know, that eschatological banquet, that final banquet. So you kind of think, well, maybe the host is God, but doesn't really say that in the parable version. They all have reasons for not coming.
Sounds like reasons for not going to church.
Yeah.
I mean, I see people in the grocery store that I haven't seen for a while in church, and you know, we were so busy, and you know, it rather than just saying, hi, it's good to see you, they have to come up and feel like they have to give me a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, sounds like you've
been. And it's not that these are especially immoral people or anything. They all have business.
Yeah, their excuses are real.
They're pretty good excuses. Mm-hmm.
But maybe it's, there's someone that hasn't given parties before and they think he's going to have another one he could come with again.
So it's the jilted part of the jilted host, really, right? I mean, is this an unpopular guy? I mean, is he a tax collector or something? It doesn't say. I mean, is he being snubbed intentionally?
New guy in town.
A new guy in town, right? Trying to, just leaves it open. But what kind of a person would all these folks turn down? It's rather interesting, each one. But he's going to have a party anyway, right?
Don't you think, too, that maybe it says a lot for the society at large? Mm-hmm. I mean, it isn't any different than what it is today, where everybody puts themselves first. And I have to do what I want to do first. I meet my own needs. And obviously that banquet or that invitation is not part of a need that I have. Mm-hmm. And I have to fulfill my own need first. And then if there's any time or any energy left over, maybe I'll throw some your way. It's a narcissistic society. Mm-hmm. And possibly that's reflecting in this year too, because people, I mean, every person is self-centered. We're self-centered from the minute we're born for self-survival, and we grow and try to overcome this self-centeredness in order to be servants, and it is difficult. And these people just haven't reached that point. Who told that story about the little girl who was standing up in front of the mirror? Where was that?
Yeah, it was Vespers.
Or no, I think Jackie read it for Matt.
Yeah, Matt, yeah.
Yeah, where this little girl was with her dad. He was a pastor, he'd written a book, and he was visiting, I don't know, book signing or something, and they were staying in a pastor's home, and the little girl was in bed with her parents. This little girl was just, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 years old. And there was a picture of Christ on the opposite wall, and there was a mirror in the back of their bed. Or was it the opposite? Was the mirror there, the picture there? Anyway, she was looking at the picture, and then she saw the reflection in the mirror. I mean, her little kid that, you know, wow, too. And then she gets up and stands in front of the mirror, and the image stops. She lays back down, and the image is back there again. And the story of the whole thing is that when you stand up and you get in the way, you get in front of Christ, you can no longer see Christ. He's not there. He just disappears. That was the total thought of the thing. And we just wipe him out by standing in front of him. And that this is the same thing here. You know, they're just meeting their own needs. And maybe it had nothing to do with the host. I suppose if it was President Clinton or something, they certainly would have accepted the White House invitation, but evidently this man wasn't of high standing.
Yeah, someone gave a great dinner, by many. It doesn't tell his status or give any indication that he should be honored or anything like that.
Just somebody who wants to give a dinner, like you and I. Mm-hmm. Unimportant people.
He's just got, one's just got, says he's just gotten married and can't come, so it seems to assume that only the males would be invited and he didn't want to leave his wife and spouse at home. Newly married are exempted from such things as military duty in Deuteronomy, so maybe he's not totally self-centered, maybe he's, he has other obligations. Perhaps someone
too.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like
they all had another commitment.
No, they had made a commitment to the host.
Oh, to the host.
Mm-hmm. And so that in a way, they had made a promise. If he had invited them and they had said they would come, and then he prepared the feast. So there was, it looks like there's a factor of them actually going back
backing out.
Yeah, on a promise or a commitment.
Well, that's an interesting point. Someone gave a great dinner, invited many, so we can maybe assume one way of reading it would be that they initially said yes. And then at the time for the dinner, when he turns out, sort of the bell's ringing, you know, okay, everything's ready and going around and getting people, then they're backing out unexpectedly. That would be one way of reading. Yeah.
Well, I guess one of the things that I find perplexing about this whole chapter that arises from the very thing you mentioned at the beginning, that this is a dramatic situation at a meal. Jesus has been invited to this prosperous Pharisee's home for a banquet. Then just before this story that we've been looking at, Jesus presumes in 12 to tell that host who he should invite, and it turns out to be the very people, the poor, the crippled, the lame, and so forth, that this next host winds up inviting after the initial people turn him down. Mm-hmm. And the transition between those two is this peculiar verse 15, when one of the dinner guests, on hearing Jesus' instruction that you should really invite the lame and the poor, that dinner guest then says, well, blessed is anyone who will eat bread in the kingdom of God. And it could be that what motivates that guest to say that is that he's a little uneasy with Jesus instructing the host who he should have invited, when in fact the host has invited a lot of, let's assume, leading prosperous people. So then he tries to kind of smooth things over, it looks like, by saying, well, anyone's blessed, not just the lame, not just the rich, not just the poor. And then Jesus tells this bizarre story, which looks at first as though somehow the guests are being rebuked, that is, the ones who didn't show up. Mm-hmm. But it could be that, it could just as easily be that the host is being rebuked for having invited the wrong kind of people. That is to say, he hasn't invited the very kind of people that the particular host has been told he should have invited in 12 to 14. So it's a, mm-hmm. it's a very complicated, dramatic situation in which this particular parable is set, and mm-hmm. it's very hard to know how exactly to interpret it, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good point about that connection there. So do you think, though, do you get the impression that Jesus is telling a parable about the kingdom of God, though, also? So it's operating on a couple of levels. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a rebuke of his hosts on one level, but yet he's also mm-hmm. presenting a greater truth, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Notice what happens is once all the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame have come, those very people that Jesus has instructed his host directly to invite, they're all in there, there's still room, and so they slave has to go out and get people off the roads, go outside the town. So you can read that as sort of an allegory, an allegorical level of going outside of Israel. Mm-hmm. Sort of the
Gentiles.
Right, the poor, crippled, the blind, the lame, or sort of the unacceptable, the marginal people within Jewish society itself. And then once they're in, there's still room. So for opening it up. Or I tell you, none of those who were invited will taste of my dinner. What a slammer to the host and to the invited guests.
Yeah. Are we to, I mean, do we assume that those who don't get to taste this dinner therefore starve somehow? I mean, is it that universal a dinner?
I think that we're talking about the bread in the kingdom of God, which has that sort of resonance of the last
thing. I don't know, something keeps running through my mind, and maybe it's a little tangential, but there's this North German legend of the Totentanz, the Dance of the Dead. There's a couple of 20th century workings out of this thing where death is a judge, and he invites people to come and dance with him. He invites the young child, and he invites the prosperous banker, and he invites the newlywed couple, and he invites, and they all must come and dance. And they all come up with their excuses. I don't want to dance with you. I've got other things to do. And he says, I'm sorry. This is the way it is. You must come and dance with me. And they all have to come. And There's one novel, it's called Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, which is a very contemporary, it's set as a Western, American Western, but it's a setting of, it's the tale of the Totentanz, and there's this judge that continues throughout the book, keeps showing up, and there's so many deaths in this novel that you can't, and yet it's not a spaghetti Western, it's a profound book, and in the end, the character that you have followed throughout, not the judge, but the protagonist, he's at a bar, and he goes into the outhouse, and there's the judge. And he'd always thought he was beyond dancing with the judge. And as I said, this may be tangential, maybe I shouldn't have brought this up, but I see that it seems like this is a way out. You can go to Christ's feast, but you're not going to be able to find the food somewhere else. I mean, death is going to dance with you.
Mm-hmm.
That there's an inevitability about all of this, which is kind of the voice of judgment is sounding, and you're not going to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. And I think that sounds pretty clearly in the other version of it too. I think this is part of Christianity's complex relationship with the Jewish roots right here, and. I mean, I find it very problematic, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's kind of the message, though. You guys who think you're in now are really out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the statements that's being made there.
I agree. It's just perplexing this someone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the someone who actually invites Jesus is a prosperous leader of
mm-hmm.
the Pharisees, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you have someone at the center of the establishment who's invited Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Then that someone is told that he should, when he has a banquet, invite the marginal ones,
mm-hmm.
the poor, the lame, etc. Which would, following the image of this being a kind of cosmic banquet, suggest that the Gentiles ought to be included. Things should be more inclusive than
mm-hmm.
they've been.
Mm-hmm.
But then the parable starts out with, it looks like the host making a similar mistake to the actual host. That is, he's invited
mm-hmm.
people who are prosperous. How do we know that? Well, one's looking after property, one's looking after oxes, and one's just gotten married. So ties of family and wealth
mm-hmm.
are the very things that keep these people from coming.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you would expect, now that the host, sort of out of necessity, is educated to broaden the number of people that are included, And so now it's all-inclusive, turns at the end and basically says, well, the establishment just will never eat here. There's a kind of, because they didn't accept the invitation, they'll never get another chance. So there's a kind of, on the one hand, inclusivity, more and more people are invited, but on the other hand, there's a kind of bitterness that the inner circle will never, what began as the inner circle, just won't finally be, they're not going to be excluded because in a way they excluded themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
Well, that sounds like a good reading. You know, the Pharisees are kind of are good guys in Luke. Look at
right.
13:31. It's on the same page in my Bible. 13:31. At that very hour, some Pharisees came and said, "Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you."
Mm-hmm.
They're warning Jesus. And Jesus has a lot of disputes with the Pharisees and so forth. I mean, he was in contact with the Pharisees. In fact, of all the different groups within Judaism, probably had more in common with the Pharisees than any of the other groups, because the Pharisees believed in resurrection of the dead, and the Pharisees wanted to incorporate in their lives every aspect of their life, their allegiance to God, holiness and so forth. So actually, Jesus seems to be more alive with the Pharisees than any of the other groups. And they're not bad people. They have them over for dinner and so forth. They have debates amongst themselves. But no, I think your reading's very good.
Well, then it could be, if it's not a religious thing, then it could be more what appears to be on its face, contrast between the
mm-hmm.
sick and the diseased, the rich and the poor.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more a matter of class.
Religion.
And it is a matter of religion.
Religion. Mm-hmm. I would prefer that reading.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You know, the Luke reading, I look at it as him not so much as bringing up the lame and sick to bring them to his level, but absolutely, really not to make them feel good, to have a contrast to those attending. Look at, they're out of place. They're in this great hall with this great food. And it's really, the host is really not trying to compliment the people he has finally sitting on his table, but more to insult the people.
Because he's going to have a party anyway, right?
I mean,
he's going to
have a party,
and
it'll be written in tomorrow's paper that
it was a big turnout.
Big turnout.
The garbage collector was there.
Only the leper poor.
And those only the leper poor will see that they were.
Only those that were. Yeah, I think you have something there. The host was snubbed by all these well-to-do. So he's like, well, I'm going to have a party anyway, and this is going to be some kind of party, right? We are going to have, like, this is going to be the biggest party in town. Everybody's going to be there, you know, except for these few that he initially invited. And, oh, what a party it was, and no, you weren't invited in the end. What would you like to say, Chris?
Well, I missed the beginning of the study, and maybe you talked about this some, but and maybe I'm overstating it, but I've always thought of Luke as a gospel of extremes and severe proposals. And one example would be the Magnificat, where the images are the high and mighty being cast down and the lowly lifted up. And certainly the prophecy of John from Isaiah about the valleys being filled and the mountains made low, and Jesus' first sermon in the temple where he talks about bringing good news to the poor and releasing the captives and sight to the blind, and some of the stark options given people that Jesus interacts with about possession, those sorts of things. So there's I just was thinking of that overall character that I associate with Luke when we were talking about a sort of question of the wealth and the outcast being included in this story, and the ones who don't come being the ones who have that sort of economic edge that Luke seems to have in his gospel.
That makes a lot of sense.
I find that a very challenging aspect of Luke's presentation.
That makes a lot of sense, because it fits in with Luke's larger theme of reversals, of the have-nots being given and the haves being stripped of what they have.
Yeah.
Excellent. Can we turn this point to the Matthew's version? I really appreciate this conversation, because I think I'm coming to see now that Matthew puts this in a place. Matthew is putting in 22 in the parable when Jesus is already in Jerusalem. In Luke, he's telling it on his way to Jerusalem, one of the stops on the way to Jerusalem and meeting with a Pharisee on the Sabbath. In Matthew, he's already entered Jerusalem, and he's cleansed the temple, he's cursed the fig tree for not bearing fruit, and then there's three parables about who will be part of the kingdom. And after that there's a number of confrontations with the Jewish authorities and so forth. So the theme of conflict, and I think maybe this is more where the followers of Jesus are placing themselves in contrast with the Jewish religion. I think I appreciate that, these insights. I think there's a different development of the story here. So why don't we read this? And I have to remind you that the Gospel of Matthew was probably put together around 80 or 85, and the temple was destroyed, was burned. Jerusalem was destroyed in 70. So you might keep that in mind. There seems to be an allusion to that. And also by this time, Christian Jews had been expelled from the synagogue as heretics because of their insistence that Jesus was the Messiah, or the Christ. So that was unacceptable. So by this time, by the time he's writing, we have this split. And so you should read this in that context. So would somebody please read 1 through 14?
Once more Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his slave to all those who had been invited to the wedding banquet, but they would not come. Again, he sent other slaves, saying, 'Tell those who have been invited, look, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding banquet.' But they made light of it and went away, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his slaves, mistreated them, and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his troops, destroyed those murderers, and burned their city. Then he said to his slaves, 'The wedding is ready, but those invited were not worthy. Go therefore into the main streets and invite everyone you find to the wedding banquet.' Those slaves went out into the streets and gathered all whom they found, both good and bad, to the wedding hall. So the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man there who was not wearing a wedding robe. And he said to him, 'Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding robe?' And he was speechless. And the king said to his attendants, 'Bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen.'"
Well, what part have we seen before, and what's new? We've had something added on. I mean, a number of king details are added, but yeah, the king as well. But in the last one, right, all the poor and the lame people were invited, all those from outside were all invited, and then the other guests were excluded. But here you also have the king coming in just to check on his guests. So that's kind of a whole additional parable. We have a kind of combining of the two. Why don't we start with the parable that we've already looked at and noticed some different features. You said the king is new. So now we have the figure of the king, and by convention in Jewish parables, the king represents God. So that already is sort of spelled out for you in this parable.
Was it a wedding banquet or just a banquet?
Well, no, yeah, it was just a banquet, a great banquet. And this is a wedding feast. So here you have the son as the bridegroom, so with all those resonances with Jesus as bridegroom, yeah. Revelation, yeah. And so forth. So it's definitely given more of the kind of the Christological interpretation already within the details of the parable itself. And this king sends slaves, so he has a lot of slaves. So the other one is just someone who sent his slave, he had one slave. And he goes and invites them once they can come, and then he sends other slaves, so more slaves. And look how he coaxes them. "Prepared my dinner, my oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered, and everything's ready, come to the wedding banquet." So he entices them with a menu. They're about away from the room. But they also resist, or coming, make light of it. In fact, they laugh at him. One to his farm, another to his business. That sounds like reference to the oxen, right? But here we have a little departure too, right? This gets really out of hand. I mean, in the other one, it's just people refusing to go to a banquet, but here the parable itself becomes bizarre. Instead of just saying no.
And violent,
right?
Very violent.
Kind of a food wars last night. Now we have fighting about being invited to a banquet somehow.
Why would people turn down a banquet offered by the king?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's an interesting slant, too.
Yeah.
Because before we discussed, well, who was giving the banquet?
Mm-hmm.
No, we really didn't know.
No, we didn't know, yeah.
He could be a man of non-status.
Mm-hmm.
But here's a man of status.
That's right.
Which is another contrast.
So, you know, one thing that parables do besides illustrating a point, they also rhetorically, through words, sort of create a perspective on a certain event or something. And so here, it's like, it's a ridiculous situation. Of course you would come to a king's banquet and why would you kill the king's... So, you know, this is ridiculous. Well, so it not only illustrates, but it presents a perspective on what's being alluded to.
One thing I didn't understand is that, well, and then he burned their city. So.
See, like it would be his city too.
Yeah.
Right?
And then they went right ahead and fight between the main streets. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really make sense.
It seems so. Like, if you think about a feudal system, the king had all these outlying barons out there with their own little cities. They may be under the umbrella of the king, but perhaps these cities belong to these land barons or whatever you want to call them. And as retribution, he burned the city and all the people that lived in it, that worked for him and with him. And even though it might have been his in the beginning, he made a statement by saying, you're not that important to me, so I can bring you anyway.
But if the king represents God and the son who's getting married represents Christ, then the messengers of Christ work it. Mm-hmm. And they're not engaged in the message.
So you're thinking about, for example, Stephen and then Peter, Paul, John the Baptist. So it seems like you have a more developed allegory here, almost a history. First the slaves that invite everybody they won't listen to, and maybe they should refer to, you know, if we take it allegorically, maybe to the prophets of old. And then when the banquet's all ready, right, then there's other slaves are sent out, not the same ones, and these are killed. And so reference perhaps to the martyrdom of some of the apostles and so forth. And then the king's angry and burns the city. Jerusalem's been burned in 70. So this is an interpretation of the burning of Jerusalem. It seems to be a much more developed sort of allegory.
And a judgment upon the Jews. And then it's like saying, well, you got what...
I think you do have the feeling of more separation between the followers of Jesus and the larger Jewish community than you do in Luke, where Jesus is eating with a Pharisee and telling a story about someone, and there's not this interpretation of the burning of Jerusalem and so forth. So you really see the two religions separated and a judgment on those that didn't accept Jesus as Christ, who kicked out the Jewish Christians and so forth. Yeah, did you want to say something?
Only that, like I was thinking about in the last story, if you don't come, there's no choice. You have no choice. You'll starve to death or get killed or something if you don't come to the feast.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only show in town.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have the option of going some other route.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true.
It's like the devil in the outhouse.
Yeah.
That's the end. Yeah, it's the end.
Everybody dances with death.
Yeah.
This is the only way out. Is if you go to the king's feast.
Yeah.